The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live at WILL AM 580 here on a beautiful December Sunday afternoon in Urbana, Illinois. We've got a terrific show for you today with a frequently requested guest, Tom Frank, author of the best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? Tom Frank is the founding editor of The Baffler up in Chicago. He's received his PhD in American history at the University of Chicago and has written widely, including three books that I've read and enjoyed greatly. The Conquest of Cool, his first book based on his dissertation. One Market Under God, which came out two or three years ago, and Tom was on the show to discuss. And then now the new best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
It's really a treat. You know, I think we had the privilege of doing your first interview on the book.
Well, it was before it came out.
That's right. I think, as I mentioned at the time, we taped the show because I was going to be out of town. We did it because your publisher graciously sent me galleys. And I gobbled up the book in about 90 minutes. Basically my kids were starving. I mean, I was just locked myself up because it was such a treat to read. And I said, we've got to get Tom on the air to talk about the book. And I knew it was a great book. I didn't know it would get the reaction it's gotten.
Neither did I.
I'm delighted for you. It really reaffirms my faith in the reading taste of the American reading public. Because, where does the book stand now in terms of sales? How are you doing?
I don't know. I don't know how many it's sold, but it's crazy. It's been on the bestseller list, for a long time.
It's shot up. And before we talk about the book, and I suspect there are some of our listeners unfamiliar with the book, What's the Matter with Kansas, and the arguments you're making, I just want to say is something I emailed you, and I don't know if you got it. I was in New York at a dinner about 8 weeks ago with Bill Moyers and a handful of other people, and Bill gave a short talk to the assembled guests at the dinner. And he stood up and he was talking about politics. And he said, there's one book that everyone has to read. It's by far the best book, which captures what the political moment of our times is. And he says, it's Tom Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas? And
it was,
and I think it got everyone's attention. And I, and on that note, let's talk about the book.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Wow.
You got to read your email.
Bill Moyers is a canny dude.
Yeah, he's a very smart guy. Absolutely. And on that note, why don't we tell listeners unfamiliar with the book?
Okay. The first thing people are wondering is, like, why would I want to read a book about Kansas?
Yeah.
And so I should say that while the book, the big part of it is about my home state of Kansas, Kansas is also serves in the book as a symbol for America as a whole, or more accurately, for the red state mentality, because Kansas is as red as a red state gets. I think Kerry only got two counties in Kansas, the same ones that Gore got 4 years ago. But it's a deep red state, and it's a place that, like I say, I grew up there in the 70s and 80s. And back then, it wasn't so determined to be. It was always a Republican state, but it had Democrats. It had several Democratic congressmen, a lot of Democrats in the state legislature, and the Republicans that it had went from being liberal to being moderate. The moderate types being Bob Dole species Republicans, and then mm-hmm. you had more liberal ones as well. That's what my mom was, a liberal Republican. And those are all gone now. And just in the last 15 years, the state has been swept by this kind of right-wing populist revolt. You can guess the content of it. Well, actually, you can't guess the content of this right-wing populist revolt. That's why I wrote the book, because mm-hmm. I was fascinated by this, that this state, has moved so far to the right. And it's not just that state. It's happening everywhere. And there are numerous horrible examples that came out of this last election of similar things going on. One of the ones that really bothered me was the state of West Virginia, mm-hmm. which, has always been the home to a particularly sort of ferocious species of class consciousness, has went for Bush by 13 points. This is a state that used to be so Democratic. I mean, the Democrats, Republicans didn't even try to compete there.
Yeah, it's like the white District of Columbia.
Yeah, that's right. And but now Bush carried it by this substantial margin.
How much of that, just on West Virginia, Tom, is due to the decline of the labor movement and the collapse of mine workers as a force in the state in West Virginia, and that, you know, just that not having organized labor as a factor has sort of fed into the process you write about in What's the Matter with Kansas?
I think that's a huge part of the problem. If you want to think of it as a problem, you know, a lot of people read my book in there. They're very happy. You know, they're like, excellent. The right wingers are winning.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're like me, if you're on the left, then yeah, it's a problem, and the collapse of labor is a huge element of that problem. And let's see, basically to try to encapsulate the book, it's about working class conservatism. It's how lots of ordinary people, average working people, have become Republicans. And these are people that really have no good economic reason to be Republicans. And 50 years ago, you know, in their parents' or grandparents' time, the idea of them being Republicans would have been a joke, you know, or conservatives anyway. It would just never happen. But today it's happening all over the country. I mean, it's been going on for a while. And so I wanted to investigate that and see what was going on. And what you find is that conservatives make a really good class-based appeal to a lot of working-class voters and speak to them in you know, using a particular a class-based way of looking at the world. And the thing is that this class-based way of looking at the world directly competes with the old class-based way of looking at the world that you see in the labor movement. But whereas the labor movement, say, looked at the world as a contest between working people and owners, working people and rich people, or blue collar and white collar, or however you want to put it, conservatives say, no, that's not what it is. It's average people, you know, authentic heartland middle Americans versus the liberal elite, versus people like you and me, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
That's the class conflict. And the thing is that the labor movement was always the sort of bulwark of this other way of looking at the world. And as the labor movement disappears as a social movement, then that this becomes a, you know, that way of looking at the world disappears as well.
We're talking to Tom Frank today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580. Tom is the author of the best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. That's what we're talking about today. The book has come into increased prominence following the election in November with the great concern about the statement about moral values and the split again between red states and blue states. And a lot of attention has gone to Tom's book. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Tom Frank, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Tom, I know I sort of cut you off in the middle of a point. Do you want to wrap that up before?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
I blab way too much.
No, I
just
love
go on and on.
That's what this show's all about. But I know we're going to get a lot of callers. In fact, we have lines filling up. So let's get to the phone lines right now. Line one, you're on the air with Tom Frank.
Yeah, I wanted to digress a little bit. I'm sure we'll get back to that other book. But you mentioned this book called One Market Under God. And, of course, that made me think of One Nation Under God. Are you talking about beyond the nation? For example, we're trying to export democracy, so to speak, if we have a democracy here to export, to Iraq, or we want to give them our gift of democracy. And I'm wondering about the neoconservative or the neoliberal, whichever way you want to put it, push to democratize the world and bring it under the does your book treat whether they want to bring it under the purview of multinational capitalist control, or and what's going to happen if, say, for example, the Iraqis don't want to come under multinational capitalist control? Maybe they
I don't talk about that in the book.
Okay.
Barely at all. I focus on the domestic issues, and you know, one of the things that fascinated me about this last election is that the Iraq issue didn't hurt Bush the way I thought it would, the way I guess everybody in the Democratic Party thought it would, that he had, you know, got us into an unnecessary war. And one of the reasons for that is that I think people, especially out in places like Kansas and West Virginia, stuff like that, and remember, these are places where a lot of people are in the Army, or there's a lot of veterans and, you know, a lot of army bases and stuff like that. And so people have a lot of direct experience with these things. And I thought that that Iraq would really hurt Bush, but it didn't. And I think that's because that war ultimately plays into or is understood by people in these areas as, or, you know, by conservatives in terms of this kind of backlash narrative, this war against the liberal elite, where every war validates this idea that liberals are cowards, that liberals are traitors. And you saw that especially this time around, where the particulars of the war didn't seem to matter very much, but John Kerry's, you know, people, you know, those things didn't really sink in. I read somewhere just today, I was reading that at the time of the election, something like over 50% of people, I'm getting the numbers confused already, but a huge number of people still believed at the time of the election that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. A lot of people believed that the U.S. had found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And this is, you know, because that fits the perception in this kind of conservative movement culture. Facts can't even put a dent in that.
Sort of faith-based politics.
Yeah, and it goes, in fact, facts often just get steamrolled by the narrative. In the case of John Kerry, you know, who was a war hero in Vietnam, but according to the backlash narrative, you know, that's impossible. A liberal can't be a war hero. A liberal is always some kind of traitor. And you got to the point where conservatives were making fun of Purple Hearts because, you know, at the Republican convention, because if a liberal got a Purple Heart, then it ain't worth nothing.
Must be
a
wimpy
joke.
Yeah. We're talking to Tom Frank today on Media Matters. Our phone lines are full. We're going to get to every caller calls in. That's my vow. 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phones. Line 2, Champaign, you're on the air with Thomas Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas?
Hi, really enjoyed your appearance on The Daily Show, which I think is funny when it's true that a lot of people are now, besides NPR, turning to The Daily Show for news. Wow, you hit on something that I was thinking about. There's this remythologizing of America. I'm not incredibly old, but I am on the other side, the top side of middle age. And I remember the Vietnam War. I was a kid and just was fortunate enough that I turned 14 the year that we didn't have to register for the draft anymore. So people, there seems to be all this mythologizing going on about Reagan, about the Vietnam War, and about things like why we lost the Vietnam War. And that's why I think it is so pertinent when what happened to John Kerry and this whole red-blue divide, because the veterans come from everywhere. And this part of Central Illinois actually is involved in the Iraq War. And I don't know, is it the consolidation of the media? Because in this town, we used to have a competitive paper until the late 1970s. And now there's all just this block marketing, and I won't mention the leader of that. But I'm just curious on your feelings about mythology and media consolidation. Thank you.
Well, yeah, how has media consolidation helped? In a lot of different ways. It's allowed the kind of conservative worldview that I describe in the book. It's allowed it to happen. And the guy who really knows about this is a guy called Bob McChesney.
Thank you, Tom.
You should read his book. In fact, Bob, I was looking around. I just moved to a new house here in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, those royalties must have rolled in, huh?
No, actually, they haven't yet. It was we got the house before the book, you know, even was published or anything like that. But and you know, this, as I say, this is all a surprise to me. But I was looking everywhere for your new book about the media, and I couldn't find it because I wanted to quote it the other day. And I can't find the damn thing, so now I have to go out and buy another copy. Anyhow, what I was going to say is, and this is something that I took from Bob's book, is that since it's not so much conglomeration, it's media professionalization, and the way they treat business news has distorted people's perceptions of reality. Now, the right-wingers claim to hate the culture we live in. They claim to hate the media. They think it's biased. You know the rap.
I mean, yeah.
They go on and on and on about this. What's funny is that I think their worldview would be impossible without the kind of changes that have happened in the media in the last 50 years. For example, one of the staples of backlash of conservative pop culture is not discussing matters economic. They're just blind to economic questions. It's all about moral questions. Everything is an abstract moral issue, right or wrong, this kind of thing. Economic issues almost never come up. Now, there are conservatives that talk about economic issues, but they tend to be in a different world. This is the libertarians and Chicago school economists and that kind of thing. But the kind of values-based conservatives, they don't talk about economics. And one of the reasons that it's possible for them to talk about class the way they do, they talk about class constantly. The good people of the red states victimized by the haughty, you know, snobs with their tofu and their lattes in the blue states. They talk about class all the time, but they don't talk about the economics, the mm-hmm. economic aspect of class. And that's only possible because of the media universe we live in, where those economic concerns have already been taken away for them, and they're you know, segregated on the business page. They're not dealt with on the news page. It's very easy to go through life these days and not ever think critically about the economic world we live in, and that's because of the media.
We're talking to Tom Frank today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Tom's the author of the brand new, or not brand new, 6 months old now, 4 months old?
Yeah, that's right, 6 months.
New book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America, published by Metropolitan Books. High atop the bestseller list, I'm glad to say. The number again, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have a line open if you want to call in. Line 3, Champagne, thanks for your patience. You're on the air with Tom Frank.
Thanks, and I just wanted to also sort of chime in on the praise for the book. I read it when it came out twice in very rapid succession. It was a very enjoyable book. I do have a question, though, about a tension that I felt when I read your book, or the argument in the book about what you call this deranged politics.
Yeah.
And the tension that I felt was between a weaker and a stronger reading of that argument. The weaker reading would be that these cultural and religious issues that you describe are important, but that they're presently overemphasized, and that what you're calling for us to reintroduce and to pay more attention to class, economic, and labor issues, or else it'll be too easy to manipulate these cultural issues against people's interests.
Yeah.
And I see a tension between that and a stronger reading, which is that these cultural and religious issues are really nothing but distractions from what would be the true basis of politics, class, labor, and that their prominence is purely a product of manipulation by the right. And let me just ask, do you agree to that tensions there? If you do, which reading would you endorse? And if you would endorse the stronger reading, why? Thanks.
Well, I probably wouldn't go as far as to say that these issues are purely that they're all purely manipulated. There is a lot of there's a lot of manipulation out there. I mean, I'll be the first to admit that. You know, think about it. The Republicans used to use the phrase Southern strategy to describe this stuff. It's all very strategic. When they discovered earlier this year the gay marriage issue, there's a story in the Washington Post about various conservative leaders, getting all excited about this. And they came up with the phrase "the new abortion" to describe it. It would be, and I mean, it really is. They were thinking in terms of manipulating people. This is an issue that they thought would have the same kind of appeal that the abortion issue does, that's why they were so excited about it. And so there is, and obviously there's these think tanks here in D.C. that conservatives have spent millions and millions and millions of dollars to build this top-down structure where they cook up these issues and that sort of thing. The problem is, though, that there is grassroots legitimacy to all of these issues, and I think we underestimate that at our peril. The people really are committed at the lowest level. I think of in Kansas, these issues have yielded a kind of, well, if it wasn't such a horrible story, a kind of flowering of grassroots democracy. In Kansas, where you've got this vicious battle going on between the two wings of the Republican Party, you know, the right-wing conservatives and then the moderates, people contest elections for precinct committee man and precinct committee woman, which are the lowest levels, the lowest job you can have in American politics, you know, like dog catcher is way above this job. Mm-hmm. And they fight over these positions. People are really energized. I came across people in the book who, a woman who had mortgaged her house, a blue collar woman had mortgaged her house in order to fund her war on public education. You know, she's in favor of vouchers. And, you know, was so deeply committed to this. And by the way, this is in an area that has very good public schools. But by God, she's had enough of them. Anyhow, so I think it's a little bit of both. And that's why I would go with the weaker of the two readings that I still think that that even though these issues have a certain amount of legitimate pull, I think that an emphasis on the economic issues how would you put it? Short circuit conservative appeals.
Tom, how many counties are there in Kansas?
Oh, I don't remember anymore.
Like 80
I used
or
to
100?
Know that 140 or
okay.
something.
Okay, and you said only two of them, no matter what the absolute total is, only two of them went for Kerry this election.
Yeah.
And I assume what's that like?
One of them is Kansas City, Kansas.
Yeah.
And the other is the county where Lawrence is, which is the University of Kansas.
Sure. So the other 100 plus counties of Kansas, which voted for Bush and which have voted Republican consistently for generation now. What's the economic situation there? Are these counties flowering? Is that a result? Is that explained?
That's, that's what you'd think. They're so Republican. You'd think they're as prosperous as, you know, because that's what you associate Republicanism with, contentment, you know.
Yeah, and certainly one county you write about in the book at length, the county you grew up in that my brother and his family live in, Johnson County, and I know it well. Certainly fits that description.
Right. Oh, it's very affluent.
Affluent,
yeah.
Suburban.
It makes sense for people there to be Republicans. And it's one of the most Republican places in America. It's in terms of voter registration. It's, you know, it's the wealthy suburbs of Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is where Sprint has their headquarters there and a bunch of similar, like Hallmark, a bunch of similar companies like that. And this place has done really well.
But what about the rest of Kansas?
The rest of Kansas has not done well. That's the funny thing. Wichita, which is the other big city in the state, has a lot of – it's a manufacturing town, like what Detroit used to be. They build airplanes there. And it's had very hard times in recent years. And, you know, with a lot of deunionization and the various companies that employ everybody there. Since I wrote the book, I've learned even more horrible things about what's happened in Wichita. A friend of mine, I met this guy the other day. He said his dad is a doctor, and he was looking around for a place in the 1970s, a city to move to in America to practice medicine. And he settled on Wichita, and the reason for that was that everybody told him it was for practicing medicine. It was one of the most stable cities in America because everybody. It's it's a manufacturing town, heavily unionized.
It's a big Boeing center, I know.
That's right. Boeing is there, Cessna, Raytheon, a couple other Learjet, and a couple other airplane companies. Everybody was in a union. Everybody had health care. It would be a totally stable practice. You live in, you know, the middle class part of Wichita, and life is great. Nothing ever happens. Today, it's just not that way at all. The, you know, benefits are cut. There's high unemployment. The companies are constantly moving the work overseas, or threatening to move it overseas. The latest thing is Boeing is planning to sell this plant, this huge factory they have in Wichita, where they build the 737s. And they're planning to sell it, and anybody can tell you what that's going to do to the city. You drive through the place, and it looks like 1933. I mean, mm-hmm. it's awful. When you get out into the more rural parts of the state, it's even worse. There's serious depopulation. Small towns, are disappearing from the map, largely thanks to a number of factors. Agribusiness and Walmart are the two main ones. I mean, small town downtowns are empty. I mean, every single one. All that you find there are thrift stores. It's horrible. It is a terrible, terrible time to be a small farmer or living in a small town that depends on small farmers. And that's the entire state. It looks really bad. And yet it becomes more Republican with each passing year.
And as you note, the purpose of the title of your book, What's the Matter with Kansas, this was not a a description that was uncommon to Kansas in the 1890s when it was suffering through a major crisis.
Exactly. And back then, people went the other way when they were faced with these kind of hard times.
It was the most left-wing state in the country.
Yeah. It had that distinction for a while.
Extraordinary as it may seem to us today, we're talking with Tom Frank, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America Today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've had several callers who've waited very patiently. I want to get to them now and thank them. Lawrence, Kansas, on the air with Tom Frank. Welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Okay, well, I just have a question. I don't understand how Kansas, being so very red, has a Democratic governor. Do you have any ideas about that?
Yeah, she was able to. There's also a Democratic congressman from Johnson County. Well, he's not. Actually, he does live in Johnson County. But there's two prominent Democrats in Kansas, and both of them were able to win using a kind of divide and conquer strategy. What happens is the two factions of the Republican Party are so. They hate each other so deeply. They tend to subvert one another after the primary is over. So in the last gubernatorial election, the conservatives won the primary and got their guy in as the Republican candidate. And a lot of the moderates, I know these people. They live around my dad's house. A lot of the moderates said, "Well, hell with that," they went with the Democrat. They guess where all the money went, and it was pretty bad. I remember at the end. And by the way, the same thing happens in the congressional district in eastern Kansas, where the 1 year the moderates will get the nomination, and the conservatives will basically stab them in the back. We'll go out and vote for the other guy, for the Democrat. And then this year, the conservative got the nomination, and the moderates did him in. It's very interesting. But while all this is going on, the Democratic presence in the state shrinks and shrinks and shrinks to the point where in the state legislature, I was just reading the other day, it's down to, I think there's 10 Democrats in the Kansas Senate out of 50. And there's a similar proportion in the Kansas House. And back in 1991, Democrats were actually a majority in the Kansas House. But that's the way it goes. Anyhow, a funny anecdote if you want to hear it, Bob.
Sure.
Actually, it's not very funny, but it's just the callers from Kansas. They might think it's funny.
Okay.
I was very interested. I'm obviously very interested in the Kansas conservatives, and so I sort of wrangled an invitation to ride on the campaign bus of the Republican candidate for governor in 2002. This is the conservative guy, and he was behind in the polls. All the moderate Republicans were giving their money to the Democrat, and he was very unhappy. He was like about to cry. Several times it was awful. Anyhow, the funny thing was, I was the only reporter on the bus. There were no others, and it was basically a great opportunity to meet all these people. Brownback was there.
That's probably why the guy was crying.
What's that?
If you're the only reporter, it's probably why he's crying. No. With all due respect,
he didn't actually cry. He just looked really sad.
Yeah.
This is the thing. He was just nobody. The guy just could not get a break. Much as I disliked his politics. You kind of felt sorry for him. He was an interesting character, though. He came from a blue-collar background, from this part of Kansas that was strip-mined earlier in the century for coal. And in interviews, he would always talk about his dad, who had been a union member and a Democrat all his life, and how his dad just didn't get it. His dad didn't get it. So this guy had switched to the Republican Party and had moved to the far right. And that was the right place for a working man to be.
We're talking to Tom Frank today, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas on Media Matters. This is a live show. We're accepting phone calls. We have a full bank of callers, and I'm going to get to everyone. Let's go back to the lines right now. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Thomas Frank.
Hi, thanks for a wonderful show again. A few observations and a question that I've always wanted to ask somebody who knew something about Kansas politics, too. Being from Chicago, I know you know how important the local offices are, like ward committeemen.
That's right.
So
yeah.
I can understand a fight like that going on in Kansas. And this show sells a lot of books, so I recommend, or I look forward to getting your book at a small independent bookstore here in Chicago. You talked about class conflict and so forth.
By the way, can I just interrupt you? I'm going to be coming to Chicago this weekend, and I think I'm going to Barbara's to sign copies of the book. So
great.
Give it a few days, and I'll have signed like hundreds of them.
Okay, I'll look for which Barbara's.
You know, I don't know right now, but it's got to be the one on the near north side.
Yeah, I
right?
bet that's the one.
They closed the one in Old Town. There's
oh,
one
they did?
Located
well, then I don't,
inside
then I don't know.
Marshall Fields, and there's one. There are several others. Yeah, that was a. Oh, and there. Oh, there's one near Navy Pier.
Well, maybe we can take this off air.
I'll figure it out. But you go ahead and ask me the question.
Yeah, my question. With the class shifting sort of thing, I wonder how the move of the Democratic Party to the right, where it's no longer seeming to make an appeal to the working class, has affected its results. I wonder if the continued scapegoating of Ralph Nader for the loss in 2000, as opposed to problems that the Democratic Party itself didn't address, and dropping the fight against the Florida disfranchisement of so many African Americans, was something that they just will not take responsibility for. My Kansas question: I've heard that. I mean, I know there's a variety in. The economy there. I've heard there are a lot of telemarketers now operating out of Wichita. I think at Lawrence, I've understood that there was a large, viable chapter of Campus Greens very active. My main thing about Kansas, though, was several years ago, 60 Minutes on CBS had a show about Pat Roberts when he was in the House of Representatives, and how he bought up a lot of land and spread it around to his friends, and they all, whether they were farming it or living on it or not, they were all getting huge federal subsidies. Well, he was finally rewarded with being booted up to the Senate.
That's right, and he's a beloved figure.
And if the Republican Party is so divided in Congress, and all the people were aware of that sort of thing, how did they react to that particular scandal?
Well, thank you, caller.
Yep. I'll admit something here. I've never heard of that scandal before. That's and I don't know how I missed that.
yeah, because you've got a bunch of them.
Pat Roberts is a U.S. Senator from Kansas. He's generally speaking a pretty a decent guy who, in my opinion, has pretends to be a conservative. He's been in Kansas politics forever, and so he is an old school Republican of the more moderate variety. But he pretends to be a conservative because you have to now to get along with these people. But Pat Roberts, another thing that he did was he was the principal author of a law called the Freedom to Farm Act, which was sort of the...
Who could be against that? Freedom
right,
to farm.
Right, it's a beautiful name, right?
Yeah.
Everybody wants to be free to farm.
Reach for your wallet, America.
What it was some of these deregulatory bills that they were passing so many of in the 1990s that sort of did away with a lot of the Depression-era agriculture regulation and various forms of price supports and this kind of thing. And it just was, it brought catastrophe for the small farmer. And this is widely recognized. I mean, everybody you talk to in Kansas who knows anything about agriculture will, curse when they hear the words freedom to farm. It just makes people angry. What's funny is that even though Pat Roberts, and by the way, it was really good for Archer Daniels Midland. It was really good for, ConAgra, for big agribusiness. It was for them. It was mm-hmm. it was the greatest thing that ever happened because it just destroyed the price of wheat, the price of corn, this kind of thing.
So it made it impossible for small farmers to survive.
Right, it makes it very hard for small farmers, but really, really good for the middleman.
Well, farmers around here in this neck of the woods understand that pretty well.
Yeah, but even though that is the case, and even though every farmer I talked to was angry about freedom to farm, Roberts ran for re-election last time around with no opponent or no Democrat. I think he had a Libertarian going after him, but
let me ask you a question about the caller made an earlier point about the Democratic Party, which I think is implicit in your.
Oh,
work.
Right, that's the other thing. Yeah,
you've got a critique of the Democrats and the way they've abandoned this fight, but also right now there's a public debate over how the Democrats should respond to the November election, which direction they should head in. And why don't you give your assessment of this?
I will. Oh, by the way, I am going to be at the Barber's. I thought it was on the near north side, but it turns out it's on the near south side. I didn't even know there was one there. at the 12th and Halstead.
Okay, great.
That's where I'm going to be. Every time they lose, the Democrats, there's a group here in Washington that basically has this lock hold on post-election verdicts. You know, the Democratic Leadership Council, and every 4 years after the Democrats are beaten, they hold some kind of public forum and announce that the Democrats lost. And it's always for the same reason. It's because they were too far to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is that the Democrats have to move to the right. That's always their answer. And they even said this about Al Gore, who was their own candidate. You know, he was one of the sort of stars of the Democratic Leadership Council for many, many years. And this time around, the same thing is going on. I don't know if it's the DLC or who is behind this push, but the Democrats are again planning to move to the right. And you have to admit that on a certain superficial level, that makes sense. That, you know, if the electorate is moving to the right, you have to move to the right too in order to go along with them. But strategically, it's if you think about it for more than just a few seconds, it's really not a very good idea. If you think about the reasons why all this is happening, the main one being that the Democrats are losing. I mean, they're hemorrhaging the white working class. This used to be the core of the Democratic Party. This is the people that voted for Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, you know, on and on and on, working class people. And these people are being converted to Republicanism en masse and have been for a long time, and it's still going on. And the way that you get those voters back is not by, you know, giving in on NAFTA or, you know, giving in on any of the rest of the, which is what Clinton did, you know, giving in on the various Republican economic, ideas, but in fact by doing just the opposite. You have to give them a reason to be, to vote Democratic, and the reason they used to be Democrats is because the Democrats were their party on economic issues. These people still tend to be liberal on economic issues, but this is the thing that is very hard for people here in D.C. to get. When Bill Clinton did his famous triangulation and, you know, adopted the Reagan economic agenda, you know, and this was supposed to be such a brilliant move, moving to the center and all that. In fact, what he did was he took away any reason for a lot of these people to vote for Democrats at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if the two parties are essentially the same on economic issues or are very close to being the same, then all that distinguishes them are the so-called values issues and, you know, various other things. But that's basically all you got left. And why not, if you no longer have a reason to vote on the economy, why not vote in terms of your moral conscience on something like abortion or stem cell research or something like that? And that's I interviewed people who explicitly told me that that was their reasoning. When Clinton went for NAFTA, that was the end. They no longer had any interest in the Democrats anymore. It wasn't their party anymore. And I think it's been a catastrophic move.
So you would recommend that if the Democrats are serious about changing the sort of current dynamic of American electoral politics, at least at the national level or at any level, they've got to go back to the New Deal playbook?
I really do think so. I think they have to be. And the other thing, there's a lot of really good reasons to do it. Another thing is that nobody knows what they stand for. They're very wishy-washy. They have no identity.
You know, along those lines, there's an interview with Karl Rove following the election when Karl Rove, of course, Bush's electoral policy
genius
said that he assigned three or four people to study Kerry once it became clear Kerry was going to get the nomination and figure out what he was selling to the American people, what his argument was for why people should vote for him. And this group threw up their hands after like 2 months and said, we can't figure out what this guy's trying to do to convince people to vote for him. I mean, they were at a loss. So they couldn't even come up with like counter stuff to go against him.
Yeah.
We're talking to Tom Frank today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Tom is the author of the best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. We have a full bank of callers who've been waiting patiently. Let's get back to the phone lines. Line two, if your cell phone hasn't gone dead, you're on the air with Tom Frank.
Hi, I've never listened to the show before, but I'm getting the general idea that this more of a Democrat or less liberal side.
Well, certainly today's show, the author is making an argument that would fall on that side of the equation.
Okay, I've got kind of nothing on the book or Kansas alone, but I've got kind of a general question. Now the cat's got my tongue here. What liberal ideas today are good? I'm not phrasing my question right. I've always seen that conservative ideas are the ideas that have made this country great. What liberal ideas today would you say are good? And it seems that when I ask people that, every time they give me an answer, I can always easily refute it with history and common sense.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's actually an excellent question. Thank you, caller. Yeah, Tom?
Bob, I was going to let you – no, I'll answer it. The caller asked about history and that conservatism is the philosophy that made this country great. And I would actually disagree with that. I would disagree with that pretty strongly. I would point out that the years in which America was had its most equitable distribution of wealth, as well as its highest productivity growth, were was in the years of a mixed economy, the 40s, the 50s, the 1960s. That once we enshrined the sort of conservative economic approach in the late 1970s, that the economy has disproportionately rewarded the already wealthy, and that the main idea of conservatism, which is free markets, is in fact not it's not what made America the affluent society, the great middle class nation that it was in our childhood.
You know, I think he was, though, I suspect that we've got to open up phone lines so he's not on the line with us, but my hunch would be he wasn't talking about economic liberalism.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You know, don't you think so? I suspect he was talking about conservative values of faith and morality and those sort of things, and liberalism not really representing those values.
That could be what he meant, but the fact is that's what the Republican Party is about. Is the free market. It's the party of big business, always has been. And the first thing that Democrats have to do if they're ever going to beat these guys is start learning how to pin that label onto the Republican Party and reminding people that that's who they are. And then, speaking of values, free market values are not the values of community and solidarity and even Christianity. It's just, the contradiction between those two sets of values. I mean, the values of the free market are, kill them all, devil take the hindmost, them what has gets, that's the values of the free market.
Let's go to another phone call. Line three, a patient caller from San Francisco. You're on the air with Tom Frank.
Hey, I just want to say the election's over and everybody's kind of hunkering down and trying to analyze and sort of forget what happened, sadly, when this war is continuing, getting worse, escalating, and the economy is getting very shaky with the drop of the dollar and our increasing debt every day. $2 billion was the last I heard that we borrow every day in this country. But I want to say that you already addressed kind of what I was going to get at. The Democrats, I'm afraid, are interpreting Mr. Frank's book to say that maybe we should be turning more, the Democrats should be turning to the right. I'm afraid that they're, I don't think the Democrats will ever really get it. But anyway, I just want to say, too, that of the books that I think are more crucial to read than ever, I would say Mr. Chesney's book, The Problem with the Media. Mr. Frank, your book is brilliant, What's the Matter with Candace, and I would add Nader's book, The Good Fight, which is the most elucidating book, one that didn't go anywhere, I don't think, as far as marketing and all of that. And I just would maybe ask one other thing. I met Mr. Frank in San Francisco, and I told him, I said, it's a wonderful book, but it doesn't really prescribe anything. It doesn't really say, what can we do? What can we do? And I said, I asked him, my idea is that Gore Vidal really nailed it. He said that what's going to happen is things will only change if there is possibly if the money runs out. And I asked Mr. Frank about it. He said he would think about it. I wonder if he would comment on that.
Okay, thank you, caller.
Yeah, I will. it's something that I think about a lot, and the book is largely a work of history, like all of my writing, and so it doesn't have a lot of prescriptions. Although I would be really chagrined if the Democrats were taking my book as a prescription to move to the right.
Well, that would be a very selective interpretation.
Yeah, I think that would be I mean, it's possible, but I haven't heard of anybody doing that. But the thing is, the question: if times get harder, will this stuff evaporate, and will the scales drop from people's eyes, and will there be a revitalized left? And this is something that I'm afraid the answer is no, because hard times are already. I mean, there's the places that I write about in the book are already really suffering from hard times. And in fact, hard times are pushing people the other direction. These people out there in Kansas are mad as hell. I mean, and in many other places too, they're hopping mad, and they are saying, "Look, the thing about the Republicans. One thing I really do admire the Republicans. In some ways, they're really a Promethean organization. They have built out of nothing, out of the ruins of the Goldwater, disaster in 1964. They have built this." Narrative and this way of looking at the world that is dominant now. And one of the ways that they've done it is by explaining, we're living in a time of great economic and cultural turmoil. There's no question about it. Globalization, downsizing, all the huge, gigantic changes that are going on. And they have sold themselves as a response to that. They are the angry party of dissent against the ruling elite. That's how they sell themselves to these people. And the Democrats don't do that. And there's almost nobody on the – well, there are some people on the left who do. I mean, there's your usual suspects, like me and Bob.
Well, Tom, let me interrupt for one second. We only have a couple minutes left, and I have callers I'm going to get to.
I just blabbed too much. I'm
no,
really
no,
sorry.
It's a pleasure. I could talk to you for all day. In fact, I should do a show with you about letting callers call in so I can hog you. But, I looked at the exit poll data, the national exit poll data for the November election. And by class basis, on income basis, the wealthier individuals get, the more likely they are to vote Republican.
Yeah.
I mean, it still shows if you're earning in the poorest quintile of the country, you vote 60-70% Democrat.
Yeah.
And the richest quintile are overwhelmingly Republican. Now, there's a slight bubble in there, like in the 50-80,000 income, where it trends slightly back towards Kerry from the general trend line. So that would sort of go against your argument to some extent. It says, that still it's voting is class-based and running towards Democrats, the poorer people are.
Yeah. But the thing is, that's certainly true.
But then the other side adds to that.
Thank goodness for that.
In fairness to you, though, if your argument, African-Americans vote overwhelmingly Democratic. If you strip them out of that overall vote, I suspect it comes a lot closer to what you're saying.
Yeah. But the thing is it's nothing like a majority of people are thinking the way I'm describing in the book or mm-hmm. I've been describing here. As with all of these wedge issues, the idea is not to convert a majority of people suddenly over to the Republican Party. Although in some places, like in Kansas, that's clearly what's happened. Actually, it's not even a majority there because as we mentioned earlier, they have this terrible fight with the moderate Republicans, and. But to put together enough, a coalition of angry people to take votes away from the Democratic Party. That's where the idea of a wedge, that slices off bits of the old Democratic coalition. So they get little bits of the white working class here, little bits of the working class there, and sooner or later the Democrats are no longer able to put it together.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest today is Tom Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. This is Media Matters. By the way, next week on Media Matters, our guest will be Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist, who will be joining us again for a live show. So let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Kankakee, thank you for your patience.
Good afternoon, Bob McChesney and guest Tom Frank, Kankakee, Illinois here. I've done with three questions very quickly. Wouldn't it be accurate to say that the November election was not really any plebiscite in the president's military adventures in Afghanistan, Iraq, et cetera, because the incumbent party and its major opposition did little to differentiate themselves from that question. In Illinois, at least, the Libertarian Party was the only one on the ballot clearly opposed to the president's military adventures.
We don't have much time, so let's get the other two on. I'll let Tom answer them, sir.
The major parties continue to completely endorse the welfare state and the major parties appear to differ mainly on the so-called values question, such as whether the states should be required to promote sexual abominations and whether the states should be required to continue to permit the murder of the unborn. Wasn't that that which upon the election was decided?
Thank you. No, thank you, sir.
I didn't even understand that. I'm sorry,
well,
Bob.
I think the first question was about that the election was not a plebiscite on foreign policy, since the parties weren't really debating that in any substantive manner.
That's unfortunate, because if it had been a plebiscite on foreign policy, I think the Democrats would have won. I think it was Kerry's a huge blunder not to make it a plebiscite on foreign policy.
And speaking again, Karl Rove certainly made it clear that he was delighted that Howard Dean was not the candidate, because they thought they were weak on that issue.
Totally. That was if there was any issue this year where the Democrats should have been just wiping the floor with Bush, it was over Iraq.
Let's go back to our last caller who's been so patient. Line one, Coles County, you're on the air with Tom Frank.
Yes, I believe that the primary problem, the main problem for the left in recent years has been the gun control issue. I don't understand why the left supports gun control. They support the rest of the Constitution, but not the Second Amendment. You know, the first year that it was a major national issue was 1993-94. The very next year, in 94, the Democrats lost to Congress. And, of course, Bill Clinton admitted that the gun control issue was the number one reason for losing the Congress.
Nicole, you're making an excellent point. We've only got about a minute left. Let's Tom answer that, because I know he's thought a lot about this. Thank you, caller.
The first major gun control act was in 1935, made sawed-off shotguns and machine guns illegal. And that has never been, stricken down by the courts. The idea that any kind of gun control is puts you on a slippery slope that's eventually going to take away your hunting rifle is, in my opinion, absurd. And this is many of these culture war issues all depend on a kind of logical absurdity at some point, and that's the problem with the gun control thing.
Well, what about it, though, as an issue that is a wedge issue that's worked successfully?
Yeah, it is, but one of the reasons it is because it's allowed to gallop out of control for years. The NRA has had a field day persuading people this, and nobody's out there disagreeing with them. I mean, I think about, it doesn't matter now, but guys like my dad, who's been a member of the NRA all his life, and it used to be about gun safety and stuff like that back in the day when he joined up, but now he gets these mailings from them and he just can't believe it. But there's nobody out there contradicting them anymore and saying it just isn't that way. The NRA used to even be in favor of certain kinds of gun control.
Tom Frank, we've only got a few seconds left. What's your next project? What are you going to turn to now?
Oh, Bob, I don't know. I'm thinking about writing. I mean, several of the callers asked me, what do the Democrats do next? What does our team do next? What does the left do next? How do we beat this phenomenon, the red state phenomenon? And since I didn't provide an answer in the last book, I feel like I kind of owe people that. I should sit down and figure that out.
Tom Frank, thank you for joining us today. Tom is the author of the brand new book, What's the Matter with Kansas?, the new bestseller, subtitled How Conservatives Won the Heart of America, a wonderful, delightful, and provocative read. Thanks again, Tom.
Well, Bob, anytime.
Of course, and I'll have you for the next book if you can count on that. And I'd like to thank Victor Picard, my producer. I'll be back 1 week from today with Paul Krugman of the New York Times. Until then, have a great week. See you later.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Classic Tan and Swimwear, Champaign; Colonial Pantry, Champaign; and Spectrum Consulting in Mattoon. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a high in the lower 50s and southeast winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, rain likely with areas of fog after midnight. The low in the lower 40s with southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, cloudy with a chance of showers in the afternoon. The high in the mid-50s with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at WILL.UIUC.EDU. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.